Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Before we get started today, I want to take a moment to say thank you to everyone who participated in our Sustainer Sprint yesterday. This was the first time we'd ever tried that, hoping to get 300 new sustaining members in just one day. We got very, very close. Thank you so much if you were part of that effort. Thank you if you are a member of Iowa Public Radio. You have built a good service, and we are working every day to make it better and better thanks to your help. So thank you for doing your part. And along with a little bit of love for public radio listeners, it's also Valentine's Day today. Love is in the air for humans and many other species as well. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here to be our cultural ambassador as we explore love in the wild. Hello, Jim.
I heard that on the way into the studio, as a matter of fact.
Nice. And when you hear that, who's talking?
Little male chickadees. It's the male chickadees that are announcing to the world that it is close to spring, or close enough for them anyway. And
they have work to do.
Yes, we do. We have a lot of snow to melt, but we're getting there. There was snow melting yesterday, even here in the North Country and central part of the state, and a lot will melt today. It was already dripping off the roofs as I walked across campus here. So, yeah, spring is in the air, and so are the songs of and not only male chickadees, and that by the way, is a lot of people think that's a phoebe, but it's not. It's a male chickadee, and so they are announcing their readiness to find a mate. But the cardinals are singing as well. You'll hear that. What cheer? What cheer? And they're out there singing as well. So it's,
now at this point in the year, it does seem really early.
It does. It does.
So is this a warm up period for songbirds, or is it really already mating season for songbirds?
No, it's actually a warm up period. They spend, you know, when you think about courtship behavior, which is what we're talking about this morning, it is sort of a ritualized sort of behavior, which reduces aggression in some ways for some species, but establishes that territory. And so the males often, depending on the species, the males want to begin that effort early so that they other males recognize that this is their territory, and the females recognize the strength of a male, and sometimes the strength of the song or the size of the territory, the other expressions of ritualized behavior, which then tell the female that he has enough resources to raise a good family. And the whole purpose is getting your genes out there, and in order to do that, he has to mate in order to pass on his genes. So he wants to make sure very early on that he begins to establish with other males, but especially with the females of the species, that he has a large territory and is a vibrant, strong male.
And the best singer?
The best singer.
The finest female?
Yeah, it depends. Sometimes it's the best singer. Sometimes it's the bird with the brightest colors. Sometimes it's the male with the largest antlers. It's all those signals. And while we can't ascribe, I think, the human feelings of love, who knows? It's certainly the ritualized behavior of humans on Valentine's Day has some similarities in other species.
Absolutely. So let's focus on song.
Okay.
Right now. We've talked about the cardinals and the chickadees, but they're not the only critters out there that court with music or with sound.
No, they're not. In fact, I did hear the other day in Costa Rica, where I was a couple of weeks ago, I heard some drumming, some... And what you're hearing, of course, are woodpeckers, and they use drumming instead of song. They have a call. Some of our bird watchers out there will recognize that the sort of calls of different sorts of different species of woodpeckers. But the drumming is actually the territorial signal and the signal to the females that, in fact, this male woodpecker has a large territory and good supply of insect larvae in which to feed the young and to feed the female.
All right. And it's very strong.
Very strong, yeah. And you'll also hear soon, I think, probably within, the next month or two, if you're farther north, in northeastern Iowa, we have a bird called the ruffed grouse, and not very many anymore, but they are certainly present in Minnesota and Wisconsin. If you go up there, you hear in the springtime and sometimes in the fall for another reason, you hear this. And he's that drumming is made by flapping of his wings on a drumming log. He has this place where he goes every day, early in the morning, often right before daybreak, climbs up on the log and stretches his wings or his head back, puffs his chest out, and then flaps those wings against his chest, and we'll hear that boom, 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 and it's an amazing sound to hear because you can't tell exactly what direction it's coming from, but you know it's a ruffed grouse because they're out there displaying. Well, we have other grouse right here in Iowa. Perhaps we can do a program sometime just dealing with the leks of prairie chickens. And they do a behavior. A lek is a place where members of the same species will come year after year to the same place. And for whatever, however it's chosen, we're not exactly sure, but the males tend to gather there. In the case of prairie chickens, the males come early in the morning, right before daybreak, and the most dominant one is in the center of the lek, and they will display to one another, and they puff up their air sacs on their neck, and they'll flare out their feathers and their wings, and they do this little sound, a deep sort of a booming, it's called, but also flapping their wings and dancing around. So they not only have a sound, they have a dance as well. And it's signaling the most dominant, the one with the most beautiful dance and the deepest voice, if you will, the deepest booming. It tends to attract the females. The females is interesting. It's sort of like a singles bar in a way for birds, where the females are standing around the outside going, what do you think? You know, they talk it over. You know.
Well, I think it's fascinating. You know, you were talking about cardinals and chickadees, and they're singing about their territory. So
right.
They're calling the females to them. They're telling the other males, hey, this spot is mine. Whereas the prairie chickens, they all get together.
They all get together. That's right. It's amazing. and that's where this lek behavior comes. They're not the only ones that do it. In the tropics, there are a whole family of birds called manakins, M-A-N-A-K-I-N-S, manakins. And manakins do something similar. They have a lek. And this is a small bird in a very dark understory of a tropical forest. And so they have to, in order to be visible and to attract a mate, they have to be loud. And you think, well, gee whiz, that makes good sense, a bird with a loud song. No, they don't use a song. They do use a sound, however, and they make it with their wings. Their wings come above their head, and they clap it so it sounds like... the snapping sound of your fingers,
mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's a single snap. depending on the species, or sometimes it's a couple of snaps with a ding at the end, and is quite amazing. You walk through the tropical rainforest, and you hear these sounds, and I'll say to the people who are with me, "Oh, there's a manakin," and they're going, "What? I didn't hear a song at all." And you don't hear a song; you hear that snapping, and the snapping is a bunch of these males in a lek in the deep dark jungle, and they'll also, some species will put a little dance with it as well. So they'll get up in the air, or they'll be on a branch, and they'll snap their wings above their head, behind them, above their head, and then they'll dance along the branch. So it's pretty cool, you know.
Yeah. Well, and we talked not that long ago about how we hear owls in the night in the
right.
deep dark part of winter. I just heard an owl out on my evening walk with the dogs just a few days ago.
Sure.
But they get started earlier than a lot of other species,
they
right?
They do. Yeah, great horned owls are actually, they were hooting back in December, and many of them, probably most of them, are already on nests. This is February. You may get some that nest a little later. There's a variation in nesting, but they begin nesting in January. So it's pretty amazing. They've established territory early, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. You think, well, gee whiz, they're not going to have much prey to offer their young ones. But on the other hand, think about the timing of this. So they establish a nest in the wintertime, when there's very little competition for nesting sites, except with maybe bald eagles, as we've found out recently. But very little competition for nesting sites. So they'll often steal another nest. They'll take an old red-tail's nest or even a crow's nest or a hollow of a tree that was used the previous year by some
other
species.
They're out there calling dibs.
That's right. And when their young are born in March, the great horned owl's young are born in March, other birds and other species are just beginning the process of having young. And so there's really an abundance, a sudden abundance of prey. So they really time it pretty well, if you think about it.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're talking about how love is in the air, not just for humans on Valentine's Day, but this time of year for many different species of wild creatures. And we'll go out here with a little muskrat love. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Whirl and it twirl and it tangle, singing and jangin' a jangle.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Valentine's Day today, and we're talking about courtship in the wild with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and very, very few creatures court with the music of Captain and Tennille. But we've already...
Who knows? You know,
I don't know.
It's possible, I guess.
You're the expert.
Yeah.
So we've already talked quite a bit about the kinds of sounds that animals make to attract a mate. Any others you want to add to that before we move on to some other courtship rituals?
Well, certainly the frogs are one that come to mind. Male frogs are the only frogs that sing, and their difference in their you're talking about an animal that lives in an aquatic environment, often very small. Frogs in the spring, some of them are as small as your fingernail, and in order to attract a mate, they have to have a very loud voice, and they want to make sure it gets out there. So certainly the frogs are one that uses song to attract the females, and you'll often, later in the summer, you get different songs at different times of the spring, depending on the species of frog, and so they'll lay their eggs over this spread of time of weeks in the springtime, and that means that sometimes that the song is important in the timing. As it turns out, frogs, of course, are ectothermic, meaning they get their temperature from their surroundings. They don't have an internal heat mechanism, so they get their body temperature from their surroundings. So if it's on a cold morning, that spring peeper, or a cold evening rather, and that spring peeper that you hear may be going very slow, sort of squeak, squeak, squeak. Whereas if it was, beyond 60 degrees, it'd be a much faster song, kind of. So they go faster and faster as they get warmer and warmer, and that actually helps them time. It's the temperature of the water and the air that helps them time when the eggs are laid, which is a good thing because then the water is warm enough to allow their eggs to develop and hatch into tadpoles, and the tadpoles will then have either zooplankton or phytoplankton or small insect larvae to eat, mosquito larvae, that sort of thing, to eat because the water is warm enough. So that timing of their song is very, very important. It's very much in tune, if you will, with the survival of their tadpoles.
Well, and definitely a surefire sign of spring because they have to wait for the warmth.
That's right. That's right. They have to wait. Sometimes they get fooled, of course. We'll have a May snowstorm. It happens, and it sets them back, but doesn't, because the water doesn't freeze completely. They can adapt pretty
right.
well.
Take a few days off and then
you
get
bet.
Back at it. All right. Should we move on to some of the sites that
yeah.
different creatures use to attract their
yes.
mates?
Yes. Now, I have had at my wife and I have had at our bird feeders for much of the winter, we've had a couple of male red-winged blackbirds. We have no idea why they're here. They're not so sure either, but they are using the feed in the feeders. You don't think of a red-winged blackbird
no.
as coming to feeders, but they do. These guys are trying to make it through the winter, but these are both males, and males are one of the ones that use a combination of sight and sound. We're used to hearing that okalee, okalee of the male red-winged blackbirds in the summertime.
Which tells runners and bikers to duck.
Being a runner, you would know that.
Yes. Right?
Because they're defending their territory. But if you watch them the next time, right before they hit you, as you're running along, you'll notice that they're flaring their wings. And that flaring of the wings also exposes a big red epaulets on their shoulders, essentially, on their wings that announce to the visually inclined that, boy, that's a bright one.
Handsome fellas.
Yeah, very handsome. And in fact, color plays a very important role, especially the reds, in many species and in terms of an attractant. And it turns out lots of experiments have been done with various birds, including red-winged blackbirds and swallows and all kinds of things. But the intensity of the color signals to the female that it is a healthy male, one that has a lot of resources, has found enough resources that allows that pigment to be brighter on them, or in fact that they have polished up that pigment maybe with their, they care enough to to polish up that wing so they're nice and clean. And you'll see red-winged blackbirds sitting along the roadside lots of times, and they're preening constantly in addition to singing and spreading those wings. But that cleaning has to do with the fact that they're attempting to show that they are the most fit male along the way. So that brightness of that color. Birds are not the only ones that do that. Fish do this as well. Male bluegills in the springtime will set up a territory in the shallows. And people can actually go and watch this. If you have a clean pond or a lake that has bluegills in it, so that you can see down, a foot or so, up to 2 feet. If you've got a nice clear pond, you can see this in the springtime because the bluegills nest near in the shallows, in 1 to 3 feet of water, and they'll make a nest, and they you'll notice you can tell the difference in the males and the females during the breeding season because of the brightness of the colors on their side. So again, that as they prepare and they clean out that shallow nest area where they're attempting to attract a female, they're developing. It seems that ritualized behavior of cleaning out the nest causes them either chemically or whatever to brighten up their colors because they're trying to attract a female. At least they occur simultaneously. Whether it's cause and effect is up for question, I guess. But the brightness of those colors is very attractive.
And with so many species, and it's not universal, but the males tend to be the most flashy and
right.
colorful.
Right. It's not universal. There are birds, actually several species of birds, where the female is the brightly colored one. She does all of the courtship. The male mates with her. She lays the eggs, obviously, because she's the only one of the two that's capable of doing that. But the male sits on the nest and raises the young. This is true in many species of phalaropes. These are a shorebird that we see coming through during migration, but they nest up much farther north in the Arctic, in the wetlands of northern Canada and up into the Arctic. So the male does all the raising of the young. The female goes off and plays cards and, you know, drinks beer. I don't know.
Again, you're the expert.
That's right. So, it happens the other way, and there are some other species that do that as well.
When I think about the bluegills enhancing their colors somehow, I think about turkeys, too.
Oh,
I
mean,
the turkey displays are really remarkable. Tell us about those.
Yeah. Wild turkeys, which are fortunately back in Iowa and doing very, very well. They were not here when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s because they had been extirpated from the state. But due to efforts on the parts of the DNR and conservationists, other conservationists around the state, turkeys are back in great strength, and they have quite an elaborate display. Perhaps most of our listeners have seen that before, where the male actually spreads his tail out, struts around. He puffs up his. He gets red in the head. So the brighter the red, the more attractive he is to the female.
So he really, I mean, he changes color for
That's
this.
That's right, changes color, bright red in the head, and struts around, going doing this boop 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 boop, and shaking his wings and then announcing through his gobbling that he is the most fit male in the area. And again, this is sort of a lek behavior because he'll often return to the same place day after day or year after year. Has to be an area that is sort of open enough for them to display, either an open area within a woodland or a field nearby. And the females are often out on the edges in the underbrush, kind of taking a look, saying, wow, this is a pretty good dancer, you know, sort of like the John Travolta of turkeydom, you know. they look that over. And, of course, hunters take advantage of that behavior as well, human hunters. But the turkeys have quite the amazing sight and sound to attract females.
Is there, if you want to see that, do you have tips for somebody who might want to go out and try to do some turkey watching?
You know, I would talk to your local county conservation board. They could hook you up with somebody who's a turkey hunter. You don't have to go out and shoot. And I know many turkey hunters who would be very happy to take people out. You have to be willing to get up early in the morning, 3:30 or 4, walk in the dark to an area, wear camouflage, sit down, be quiet, and watch watch the action. It's quite fun. There may be some county conservation boards that actually have some opportunities for people with a blind or something like that set up, but I'm not aware of any, but it would be a great opportunity to get people out there who aren't necessarily hunters with a gun, but maybe hunters with a camera.
What other spring displays do you like to get out and see?
Well, one of my very favorites are the dancing of the sandhill cranes. And if anyone wants to, you should plan now to go out. You can see it again in Iowa. Fortunately, we now have some cranes nesting in Iowa. But to really see the behaviors, guaranteed, you can go out to Kearney, Nebraska, and that area. There's about a 90-mile wide funnel where most of the sandhill cranes in North America go through this little funnel along the Platte River in Nebraska, and you can go out there in the spring and watch them as they migrate north, and you can see 400,000 to 500,000 cranes all migrating together, and it's pretty spectacular. And they will do this incredible dance. I talked about courtship behavior being ritualized behavior, and we see this in lots of birds, and in the cranes, it is particularly spectacular. They do, they face one another, the male and the female. They'll bob their heads up and down in a very ritual behavior. They tend to stomp their feet, and then they will leap into the air. And one might say it's a leap of joy, you know, but whatever it is, it's a leap. And
it's spectacular.
It is spectacular. And they leap up into the air and then come back down to the ground. And again, proceed with this head bobbing and head rubbing against one another. It's quite interesting to watch. But the dance of the sandhill cranes is just spectacular. That's one of my favorites. Another one, of course, we can see similar behavior. It's a different ritual, but similar behavior in mallards. And mallards are present in city and county parks, and state parks all over the state. Any place there's water, there seem to be mallards. And the mallard males and females also participate in this head shaking and tail shaking, and then they swim towards each other, arching their necks back, and they'll whistle at one another. It's interesting because the female mallards will often display to kind of provoke the males into displaying. The females are saying, "Hey guys, let's hurry this up a little bit, okay?" So you know, they'll do some provocation displays as well.
How about the woodcock? That's another one that's, you can hear the woodcock, but also there's quite the dance that goes along
there
with it.
There is, and it is an amazing dance. And you should prepare to do this, I would say, within the next month or so. You may begin hearing woodcocks. Woodcocks are a very strange-looking shorebird that does nest in Iowa. Most people don't see them. We don't have as many as we used to have, but there are still some around, and you can see them and hear them in the springtime. You have to go out. You don't have to get up early. You can do it because they do this in the early morning hours too, but you can go out in the evening and at a certain light, hide yourself, wear black, hide yourself in the bushes. You have to have a dance floor out in front of you that is rather short grass. It needs to be an area 10 to 20 feet wide in all directions so that they have room to dance. And the male woodcock, this is a bird that has sort of his eyes. He's a long bill because he probes for earthworms for food, very rich food. And they migrated back from South America. They have a long migration like many shorebirds do. And they have their eyes sort of halfway up the outside of their head. It's so that they can see up as well as to the side. It's quite a weird-looking bird. And they especially do this when they dance because the males will come in on the dance floor and they've got a very short tail, but they'll push it up behind them, and they walk around and kind of bob their head forward, and they're going beep, beep. And it's this painting, P-E-E-E-E-N-T, painting, that is the first part of the dance, but that's not all there is to it. So as they walk around, they're strutting around. They're not walking. They're strutting around, and they're doing this whole head-bobbing forward routine sort of walk like an Egyptian, you know, kind of thing. And their head is bobbing forward. And then they'll fly up in the air, and their wings make a noise as they fly up. And they fly up in this huge circle over the dance floor so that they can barely be seen up in the sky. And the wings as they go kind of go, I don't know if you can hear that. It's a high whistle as they fly, because their wings actually make the sound with their wings. They reach a height, and then they dive back down to the dance floor, and you hear this, and then they beep, beep. So, and it's supposed to be very attractive to female woodcock. So.
And it clearly is. All right, we're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about courtship in the wild this hour as we celebrate Valentine's Day with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about courtship in the wild with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And all right, we've talked about the sounds, some of the songs and other performances that animals put on to attract their mates. We've talked about the dances or the sights, some of the sights. Anything else you want to add before we move on to maybe odors and gifts?
Right. Gifts, I think, is a big part of the sight. For example, food, and we humans do this with giving chocolates and other candies to their mate. It's ritualized behavior for sure. And but what a lot of other species do it as well. Now, they don't use chocolate, to my knowledge. I don't know of any species that uses bitter chocolate in the jungle to advertise them. Perhaps there are monkeys that do it. I'm not sure. But certainly birds do it quite frequently. Right here in our own backyards, bluebirds will, the males will make offerings of delicious worms, particularly you can actually simulate this by putting out a mealworms out for the bluebirds, but the males will actually make offerings to the female, and it is attractive to her, and she actually behaves. Sometimes you'll see this, that's fluttering of feathers, like a young a bluebird does, trying to coax a meal from their parent. She will simulate that, a very similar behavior, and the male then feeds her. Common terns, and there are a number of tern species that do this. If they're colonial nesting, common terns have been known to walk around the colony with a fish in his mouth, going, "Hey, look what I've got! You know, hey, baby,
this could be yours.
Yeah, come with me." It's amazing. We're humanizing, of course, but it is very common in warblers. It's common in bluebirds, in cardinals and chickadees. We see this ritualized feeding behavior. Again, it's not chocolate, but it is a very delicious piece of fruit, or an insect, anything like that. It's quite amazing that they will do this. Some species, like the bowerbirds, use shiny rocks or shiny pieces of whatever they can find, pieces of glass or foil and like that, to attract them. So it's a way of giving a gift that says, hey, you know, I'm really something. I can give you these gifts our whole life long.
This will never end.
Never ending. Right, right.
Are there species that build nests to attract a mate? And this is a house I built for you.
Yeah, exactly. And the bowerbirds are the ones that we often see the most elaborate nests. But we have species right here, and those are tropical. We have species right here that do the same. There are are a number of hawks, for example, our Cooper's hawks, build dummy nests. And there's a debate about why they build this dummy nest. So the real nest is someplace hidden, but there's, in a more open area, is this sort of dummy nest. And the pair will, early in the season, will be around that nest quite a lot. Now, some will argue that that is simply a way of diverting attention of potential predators, particularly on the nestlings on the eggs, to another location. But others will say it is ritualized courtship behavior, because the male usually builds the nest and is saying, hey, look at the kind of nest I can build. And orioles will do the same thing. They'll build a real nest and sometimes will build a dummy nest as well. And it's the quality of that nest that is maybe attractive to the females, and we'll take up housekeeping together. We'll see this in woodpeckers. Woodpeckers, a male will excavate a cavity, and if the female doesn't like it, he's got to go excavate another one. It doesn't have the good housekeeping seal of approval from her, and so he will go and excavate another nest in another tree. So, nest making is a very important one. I will say that there's one that as humans we often claim that we get cross signals from one another when it comes to courtship behavior, and it happens in other species as well. Sometimes for really bad intentions, the fireflies or lightning bugs. Each species has a different flash pattern. The length of the flash, the frequency of the flashes, the time between the patterns, those differ between species. And it's quite interesting. It's usually the females down in the grass that are flashing this pattern. And it makes sense that different species would have different flashes for species recognition, different patterns, different intensities, that sort of thing. And then the males are flying above, repeating that flash, and will come down to the ground to mate with the females. So some females, particularly larger species of lightning bugs, of fireflies, will have learned how to flash a false signal. In other words, a signal of another species. The male comes down, they eat him. It's boy, talk about getting your signals crossed. Boy, it's false information.
Wow.
And it costs them their life. So it's it happens in other species.
No, I made a lame mom joke in the billboard today, mentioning smelling a skunk walking past,
yes.
possibly out looking for a date. But this is the time of year when we start to see or hear or smell some of the creatures that have kind of disappeared during the winter months, right?
Yeah, exactly. And skunks are one of them. Usually for skunks, the reason we smell is because they've gotten hit
right.
on the road. But what's happening right now is that male skunks are coming out of their winter dens. These are not skunks. Striped skunks are not hibernators. They don't hibernate through the winter, but they do go through periods of long periods of sleep, and they'll get up and eat and find something to eat. They'll come to your bird feeder and feed in the at night with the stuff that's spilled out of the feeder, other things. So the males, however, are coming out of their dens, and they make their rounds in their territory because they know where the females have denned up for the winter. And they'll go make their rounds. They'll check on Mabel and Henrietta, and make sure that they're fine. And so the males are out wandering around, and sometimes they get hit on the road. And so we will this month will begin to smell skunk. That particular odor is not a pleasant one. It is made as not as an attractant, but rather as a repellent, and it works pretty well to keep things away. But so that smell is one, because the males are out checking out the females in the area to make sure that they're okay and they've come through the winter all right. They will also sometimes take them a gift. as well. So it's a gift of food. But there are a lot of other animals, particularly mammals. Birds are very visually oriented, and they tend to see best in the red end of the spectrum. So reds and birds are usually used in courtship behavior very, very much. And they're sound-oriented. But mammals, on the other hand, are pretty much colorblind. And so colors don't mean much to them. But they have these wonderful, well-developed parts of their brains that connect to their nasal cavities. And so smells are very, very important means of communication with other members of their species. And some of those smells we can smell. We know when we've been around a fox den, when you're walking along, because you can smell that fox. That fox urine is very, very powerful. Some people claim that they can smell deer urine. I can't. I'm not that sensitive to it. But male deer in the fall of the year do use urine as a signal, along with glands that are in both in their heads and in their back feet to signal that it's their territory. And that, boy, they are really strong and vital, and they'd be the best buck around. Lots of antelopes and goats, and both wild and tame, will use urine and these glands to put off a smell that is attractive to the opposite.
So Billy goats are supposed to smell good.
Oh, that... man, yeah.
They have a strong odor.
Oh, they do. Yeah, they'll literally pee on their heads, and it's pretty powerful. It sure is, and it's supposed to be attractive. The glands the musk glands in a lot of the mustelids in the mink. And the weasels, and certainly in beaver, and in some canids, some dog family are used to mark their territory and to the smell is supposed to stimulate. It stimulates estrus in some female of species, and so that smell of the urine and the smell of their glands actually stimulates them to come into season, so and to ovulate. So it's quite fascinating, and it doesn't just happen in males. Insects are very, very oriented towards smells in the forms of what we call pheromones. They're not smells that we can smell, but other insects can, much more sensitive than we have. In fact, there are some large species of moths that the smell, in Cecropia moths, for example, if you put out a female in a freshly hatched or just come out of the chrysalis stage moth, female Cecropia moth in a wire enclosure, a screened enclosure, in the morning, she may attract 10 or a dozen males from up to several miles away. The pheromone she puts off is powerful enough to attract male Cecropias from a very, very long ways away. It helps synchronize mating, and that's a good thing. And therefore, they're most likely to produce offspring. And that's the whole idea. You want to get your genes out there. That's what mating is all about. As a species, you want to propagate the species. So you try and get your genes out there. And some are using sounds. Some are using sight. And these insects are using smell in a very, very effective way.
We have this comment from Greg and Karen in Story City. We watch the male red-winged blackbirds strutting their stuff in our backyard, and there's always one who really goes all out in size and color and kick-butt attitude. They have a winner
right.
in their yard. Ralph in Brooklyn has a question. It's not quite courtship-related,
okay. But
I know it's one you can answer. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, there was a bear killed down by Montezuma several weeks ago,
uh-huh.
and then on Interstate 80, and somebody else seen one about 2 weeks after that. When do bears hibernate?
Bears actually don't hibernate per se. Black bears are getting male blackbirds. Black bears are searching for territory, and when their territory fills up, the young males get kicked out, and they keep traveling until they find an open territory. And these bears that we found in Iowa this winter have come down from the north. And they're not true hibernators. They do reduce they don't go into deep states of torpor. They do sleep for long periods of time, just like skunks and raccoons and squirrels do as well. But bears do go a little deeper into torpor than some of the others. But that's really only in the far north. Bears in southern Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, don't go into that deep a torpor. So they're the male.
And we certainly had some warm weeks this winter.
That they can get up and feed, and that's what they do. And the males that we're seeing, or the bears that we're seeing in Iowa, are all probably young males, and they've all come down from the North Country, probably in Minnesota.
Well, Ralph, thanks a lot for your question. And you are constantly reminding us on this program, Jim, when we talk about species that we romanticize a little bit, that they mate for life is something we love to say. And you remind us that most species are serial monogamists.
Yeah.
But when we look to nature, what are some of the species that do seem to stick with a mate for a very long time?
Past seasons, in fact, many species are seasonally monogamous, so that they stay with their mate for that season. But among bird species, it would be things like swans. Trumpeter swans are long-term across seasons, across several seasons, in fact, so that they're monogamous for, you know, up to several years anyway. And bald eagles are often monogamous for many years. But the more we find out through genetics, we find out that there's a whole lot more messing around out there than from a species standpoint, it makes sense. You want to have a greater variety of genetic opportunities to get your genes out there, and so therefore maybe there's some what humans would call cheating, but and we do call it that. But in other species, a matter of hedging your bets, basically. Often a female duck will mate with several males to make sure that the healthiest ones survive. So, there are some species that are long-term across several years. Even we believe some cardinals are more than seasonally monogamous. Actually, are monogamous for at least two years or more sometimes. So there are some, but not many.
Well, and speaking of people who beat the odds, or creatures who beat the odds, I want to mention that you and your wife celebrated your 50th wedding anniversary this year. So
yes,
well
did.
Done to you.
Thank you.
You could probably do a whole show giving the rest of us advice.
Oh, no. Lots of luck and perseverance.
Well, happy Valentine's Day
thank
to you.
Same
and
to you.
Cindy. Thank you so much, Jim Pease.
My pleasure.
Jim Pease, wildlife biologist, emeritus associate professor in natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. We'll go out with a little Nat King Cole.
Wonderful you came by. I was humming a tune, drinking in sunshine, went out of that orange-colored view.